All right. Good morning. Welcome to week three already of RT-110, Introduction to Mechanical Ventilation. This is your midterm exam review. Your midterm is on July the 17th at 8 a.m. in room 213 here on campus. Your midterm is worth 50 points. It is a total of 50 questions with 3 extra credit questions. And there is multiple choice, and it looks like it's pretty much all multiple choice except for, yeah, it is all multiple choice. There's a couple in the 40s there that gives you some ventilator information. And then it asks you a multiple choice question following that data. There are a couple of questions that ask you to calculate something, but you would need to pick the correct calculation or the correct answer out of the multiple choice answers provided. So, you know, if you get the math close, you'd be able to probably figure it out from your answer from there. So, again, your midterm exam is from the beginning of the term up until the end of the end of next week. So you are responsible for knowing the data from week four, which is next week before your exam. Excuse me. Okay, so let's get a move on. The first one's a very simple question. It is basically a question about respiratory alkalosis and which of the following pieces of data is inconsistent with respiratory alkalosis. I leave this question because about 30% every term misses this question because they do not read the question correctly. And it says, which of the following would be inconsistent with respiratory alkalosis? So that means you find the one that's not respiratory alkalosis. The next question is about the oxygen hemoglobin dissociation curve. A lot of people miss this one too, so make sure that you have an understanding of what does this curve depict, the relationship of what. Question three, if a patient has a tidal volume of a certain amount of milliliters and their respiratory rate is blank per minute, what would be their minute ventilation? So you just need to calculate their minute ventilation. And I see there's a typo on that. That should not be, it should be beats per minute or not liters on a respiratory rate. Way to go, Cal. All right. So again, you just need to be able to calculate minute ventilation, which you should be able to do without any issues. Which of the following statements about alveolar ventilation are true? Okay, so make sure you know what is alveolar ventilation, how do you calculate it, what are the different components of alveolar ventilation, what does it represent, etc. Next question is about negative pressure ventilators, and it causes air to enter the lungs by increasing which pressure? Okay, negative pressure ventilators cause air to enter the lungs by increasing what pressure? And you have a choice of four there, transairway, transpulmonary, transrespiratory, transthoracic. You need to know what changing all four of those pressures does, okay, and how that affects respiration and the lung. Again, those are transairway, transpulmonary, transrespiratory, and transthoracic. There's a fabulous diagram in your book. I don't have the book open at the moment, but there's a wonderful diagram in your book that kind of depicts all of those and talks about that. I believe that was, I don't know if it was last week's or not. It might be this week's. Question six. A patient has acute pulmonary edema from the left-sided heart failure and acute hypoxemic respiratory failure that has not responded to conventional pharmacological and oxygen therapy. As the next line of therapy, you as the respiratory therapist would recommend which of the following? Okay. So they're telling you you've got somebody with pulmonary edema with due to left-sided heart failure with acute hypoxemic respiratory failure, but conventional pharmacological and oxygen therapy has not worked. Okay, so they've tried the Lasix already, they've probably even tried a positive inotrope already, and oxygen, and it's not worked. So what's your next recommendation? One of the physiological goals of non-invasive positive pressure ventilation in acute respiratory failure is to improve gas exchange by doing what? Okay. So how is it that BiPAP works and improving gas exchange. Okay. It's really, really, there's a lot of BiPAP questions on this test, and I'm going to talk quite a bit about it here on this review. It's very important that you understand how BiPAP improves gas exchange. Okay. When you have somebody who's in acute respiratory failure, part of the reason that we're putting them on BiPAP is to rest their respiratory muscles. We're taking over some of that work of breathing for them because they can no longer maintain their own work of breathing. That's why they're in failure. The primary goal of non-invasive positive pressure ventilation in the acute care setting is to do which of the following? Question 9 is a patient scenario, and there's quite a few patient scenarios on this particular test. A 75-year-old man with a long history of COPD is brought to the emergency department with shortness of breath. He has persistent productive cough with green purulent sputum, cyanosis of the lips and extremities, and he is somnolent. I think I misspelled that too. Way to go. And I give you his blood gas on a 2-liter nasal cannula. And then I ask, what is the most appropriate action at this time? So based on the description of the patient I gave you and the blood gas, you're going to determine what it is you want to do with this patient, okay? Question 10 is also a patient scenario. 61-year-old female admitted last night for shortness of breath. She is currently alert and oriented, but very anxious. I give you her blood gas as well. Her breath sounds are decreased throughout with fine, late crackles on inspiration, which is very classic for a certain thing. The current chest x-ray shows an enlarged heart with bilateral vascular congestion. The most appropriate therapy for this patient is what? Okay. When you're looking at BiPAP questions, you need to remember which pressure is good for what. So if you have somebody with a CO2 retention problem, then you would adjust IPAP. IPAP is making difference in ventilation. Ventilation is CO2. EPAP is for oxygenation. Okay, it's just like PEEP. It kind of stents everything open, gives longer for gas exchange to occur. Also remember, when you're adjusting IPAP or EPAP, the pressure between the two is pressure support, and that's how you get tidal volume. So the bigger the pressure support, or the bigger the difference between the IPAP and EPAP, means the bigger the tidal volume. The bigger the tidal volume, guess what? The more CO2 you're going to blow off. Okay, I hope that makes sense. You really have to have a thorough understanding of that now that we're moving forward, and especially for this exam. You really need to understand BiPAP. So if you don't get BiPAP, you better reread the chapter, ask some of your therapist questions, call and talk to me. But you need to understand BiPAP. And the simplest, easiest way to remember it is IPAP is for ventilation, which is CO2. EPAP is for oxygenation. Next question is another patient scenario. A 62-year-old male patient with COPD is being seen in the pulmonary clinic for dyspnea at rest and daytime hypersomnolence. The patient has been hospitalized 3 times in the past year for COPD exacerbations and once for pneumonia. He is currently using 2 liters of oxygen at home from a concentrator at all times. The patient reports that he's able to only sleep about 2 hours each night and that he has a headache every morning. Which of the following would you recommend to the physician? Okay, that description completely describes a certain type of patient. Headache every morning, only sleeping 2 hours each night, the tiredness during the hypersomnolence and tiredness during the day, the dyspnea at rest. And so you have several options here of what you should do for this patient. The other key is this guy is on 2 liters continuously. That means he's on O2 24/7. All right. Next question. You have a patient who was diagnosed 1 year ago with amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, ALS. He's being seen in his primary care physician's office. He is complaining of fatigue and inability to concentrate at work. His forced vital capacity is only 45% of predicted, and his PCO2 is 47 millimeters of mercury, and his maximum inspiratory pressure is 54 centimeters of water. Which of the following would be considered for this patient? Again, this patient has a neuromuscular disorder, and he's got some problems here. His forced vital capacity is only 45%. His CO2 is just starting to climb, just a touch. And his maximum inspiratory pressure is, I'll leave the determination for you, what you think about that. So this guy, though, has ALS, or Lou Gehrig's disease. okay? He's starting to have some issues, obviously. If he's having trouble concentrating at work, he's constantly tired, there's some issue there. So what is it that you want to do to treat this patient? Okay? To use CPAP successfully, a patient must have which of the following? Okay? To use BiPAP or CPAP successfully, the patient has to be breathing spontaneously. Okay? None of that other stuff matters. If the patient's not breathing, they have no business on CPAP or BiPAP. They need to be intubated. The leading cause of patient discomfort and noncompliance with non-invasive positive pressure ventilation is which of the following? This is a commonly missed question as well, because people want to pick mask type and fit, which again is a problem. But when it breaks down, most of the patients complain that it dries out their nasal mucosa. That's the number one complaint, even over mask discomfort. So I just gave you that one. Which of the following BiPAP settings produces the greatest tidal volume with all other variables being equal, meaning airway resistance and lung compliance? So again, you're just looking for the one that produces the biggest tidal volume. Another patient scenario, a 75-year-old man who's 75-year-old, 5'7" female patient with an exacerbation of COPD, placed on BiPAP of the following settings. I'm not going to tell you what the settings are. I give you her respiratory rate and her FiO2 and the approximate tidal volume she is receiving on those BiPAP settings. Then I give you the blood gas an hour later after being on those BiPAP settings. Then I ask, what action would you take? Okay, so you need to look at several things. You would look at the blood gas after she's been on it for an hour. If she still has a ventilation problem, then obviously her tidal volume is not adequate and you need to improve that pressure support. So you most likely increase your IPAP. Okay? Or do you think that she's so far gone that we have to intubate? That is the choice you need to determine once you read that question. Next question, 68-year-old man, 5'10" with an acute on chronic respiratory failure due to his COPD has been placed on BiPAP of the following settings. The patient's measured exhaled tidal volume is blah, 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 with a respiratory rate of such and such, and I give you the resulting blood gas. What action should you, the respiratory therapist, take? So you kind of see a pattern here. You need to be able to look at what the patient's settings are, assess the patient, look at what kind of tidal volume are they getting, what is the resulting blood gas, do we still have a ventilation problem, or do we still have an oxygenation problem, or do we have both? Always remember, though, you only make one change at a time. So you need to determine what is the most important change. A patient with central sleep apnea uses a nasal mask with non-invasive positive pressure or ventilation at night. The patient complains of nasal congestion. What action should the respiratory therapist take? Respiratory failure due to inadequate ventilation is known as which of the following? Okay. Is that a hypoxemic respiratory failure? Is it hypercapnic? Is it compensated? Is it chronic? What is it? Question 20. The underlying physiological process leading to pure hypercapnic respiratory failure is which of the following? So what is the physiology that causes a pure hypercapnic respiratory failure? Okay, no other anything involved. It's just pure hypercapnic respiratory failure. Question 21. A patient with an opiate drug overdose is unconscious and has the following ABG results. Which of the following best describes this patient's condition? And then I give you chronic hypercapnic, chronic hypoxemic, acute hypercapnic, all respiratory failures. You determine which one is it. Is it acute? Is it chronic? Is it hypoxemic? Or is it hypercapnic? Acute hypercapnic respiratory failure may be caused by which of the following? Hypercapnic respiratory failure due to increased work of breathing will be caused by which of the following? So which disease process or problem that I list here causes respiratory failure due to an increased work of breathing? People commonly miss that one too, and I'm not sure why. You need to look at the disease processes I list and determine which one really causes an increased work of breathing. Question 24. A post-op patient complaining of dyspnea is found to be tachypneic and tachycardic and somewhat confused. Breath sounds reveal in inspiratory crackles in both lung bases. An ABG is drawn and reveals a respiratory alkalosis with mild hypoxemia while on 30% air entrainment mask. The most appropriate respiratory intervention would be a patient with inadequate ventilation, inadequate oxygenation of the brain may display which of the following conditions. So if you've got somebody who's not getting enough O2 to the brain, what kind of symptoms are they going to display? Question 26, the respiratory assessment of a 44-year-old female diagnosed with myasthenia gravis shows a vital capacity of a certain amount, a negative inspiratory pressure of a certain amount. She is 5 feet 6 inches tall and weighs 188 pounds. Her most recent ABG on 2-liter cannula is blah, blah, blah. The most appropriate action for this patient would be what? Okay, so we're looking at somebody with, again, a neuromuscular disorder. We can look at what her vital capacity and her maximum inspiratory pressure, and you can look at her height and her weight and determine what kind of tidal volume do you think she should normally be producing, and then look at her blood gas and find out, okay, what's our problem with her blood gas? Is it a respiratory acidosis? Is it a respiratory alkalosis? What's going on? And then you can determine what is the best thing for her. Again, remember, if you've got somebody with a ventilation problem, it's adjustments in IPAP. If it's strictly an oxygenation problem, it's adjustments in EPAP. With this particular patient being a neuromuscular patient, I'm not going to think that CPAP would be adequate enough. But again, you know, you need to look at your data and determine that yourself, because I could be misleading you if I so chose. You have to look at the entire picture. Which of the following values are indicative of acute respiratory failure and the need for ventilatory support? So again, now you're looking at, this would have been right out of your indications for mechanical ventilation chapter, things that cause acute respiratory, or I shouldn't say things that cause, indications of acute respiratory failure. So you're looking at measurements. So you're looking at things like maximum inspiratory pressure, dead space ventilation, vital capacity, somebody's pH, those type of things. A 46-year-old male presents to the ED with a chief complaint of shortness of breath. Physical assessment reveals he's tachycardic with a blood pressure of 138 over 80 and a respiratory rate of 25 with accessory muscle use. Breath sounds are decreased with bilateral inspiratory and expiratory wheezing with prolonged expiratory phase. The peak expiratory flow rate is 100 liters per minute. The immediate action by you, the respiratory therapist, should include which of the following? Now, the key in this question is the immediate action. So what is it that you can do right then, immediately? Not go confer with the doctor, not help the doctor do, but something you, the respiratory therapist, can do immediately at that bedside. People miss that one, hence why I'm stressing it. All right, 29. A 55-year-old male with acute dyspnea admitted to the hospital. He's alert and oriented. His physical exam reveals a heart rate of 120. A blood pressure of 146 over 88, and a little bit of a fever. His respiratory rate is 28, shallow, and labored. Breath sounds are decreased throughout with fine late crackles on inspiration, and chest expansions decreased in both spaces. Patient is not coughing. I give you a blood gas. I also tell you he's a retired worker of a steel factory of about 38 years and has a 50-pack year history of smoking. The most appropriate action for the respiratory therapist to take at this time is which of the following? Okay, so again, lots of patient assessment, lots of patient scenarios based on the assessment I give you. You need to determine what is the right thing. Question 30, a 28-year-old female admitted late last night for weakness, what appears to be an ascending muscle paralysis. Okay, the patient is alert and oriented. Physical findings reveal a good heart rate, good blood pressure. She's afebrile and her respiratory rate is 24, shallow, with bilateral decreased air entry and no adventitious breath sounds. I give you her blood gas, and then I ask for what is the most appropriate suggestion that you would make at this time. Okay, so she has an ascending paralysis. Remember, with myasthenia gravis, it's mind to ground, and Guillain-Barré, it's ground to brain. If it's ascending, it would be in the ground to brain scenario, so you're going to suspect this lady has Guillain-Barré. So, based on that, you should be able to pick out what it was you should possibly be checking in the answers there. And with any type of these patients, if they're doing somewhat okay, then we need to monitor them, and we need to monitor certain things. I'm not going to tell you what those certain things are. You should be able to know what those are when you're looking for respiratory muscle weakness and respiratory strength, those type of things. Question 31. The first ABG for an asthma patient in the ED reveals the following, and it actually gives you a respiratory acidosis, respiratory alkalosis with a very mild hypoxemia, and that's on a 3-liter nasal cannula. I also give you their peak flow measurements, their respiratory rate, and their heart rate. You give them a continuous treatment over 1 hour, and then you draw a blood gas. I give you a secondary blood gas. On a high flow nasal cannula at 15 liters per minute, I now show you their new peak flow rate, their new respiratory rate, and their new heart rate, and I give you a new description of how the patient looks. Then you need to suggest what you're going to do at this time. I don't want to give this question away, but you really need to pay attention to this question. This is going to be your classic asthmatic patient that comes in through the ED, and they're going to start out looking okay, and then they go bad fast. That's all I'm going to tell you about question 31. Question 32. A patient in the ED exhibits paralysis of the lower extremities. That is getting progressively worse. Vital capacity is 6 mL per kilo, and their maximum inspiratory pressure is negative 17 centimeters of water, and their O2 sat's 89%. Blood gases are pending. The physician suspects Guillain-Barré. What is the most appropriate action at this time? Which of the following values are indicative of acute respiratory failure and the need for ventilatory support? That kind of looks like a question from earlier, but it is slightly different, and it's a multiple question. So you would need to look at your choices are, 1 and 2, 2 and 4, 1 and 3, etc. The disorders that cause respiratory failure due to an increased work of breathing include which of the following? That's another multiple. Which of the following patients is not showing the signs of acute respiratory distress? So I give you four different descriptions, and you're looking for the one who is not in respiratory distress. And I even capitalized it for you. So hopefully you pay attention. Question 36, a 59-year-old patient in severe respiratory distress in the ED. The patient is being treated for congestive heart failure and pulmonary edema. Vital signs are a pulse of 98, respiratory rate 23, and a blood pressure of 138 over 98. The patient's arterial blood gas results on a non-rebreather mask are the following. What is it that you would like to do at this time? Okay. So I will leave you to that one, but note that his blood gas is on a 15-liter non-rebreather mask. The body's mechanism for conducting air in and out of the lungs is known as which of the following? External respiration, internal respiration, spontaneous ventilation, or mechanical ventilation. You need to be able to understand the definition of all four of those types of respiration. Which of the following are involved in external respiration? The pressure required to maintain alveolar inflation is known as which of the following? Transairway pressure, transthoracic pressure, transrespiratory pressure, or transpulmonary pressure. Again, look at that diagram, be able to know each of those individual pressures and what a definition of and what it is they do. Calculate the pressure needed to overcome airway resistance during positive pressure ventilation when the proximal airway pressure is 35 centimeters of water and the alveolar pressure is 5 centimeters of water. So again, you're looking at the pressure needed to overcome airway resistance during positive pressure ventilation. I give you the proximal airway pressure, PAW, and I give you the alveolar pressure, the PA. And you need to be able to understand what that pressure is to overcome the resistance. That's a simple math question. The term used to describe the tendency of a structure to return to its original form after being stretched or acted on by an outside force is which of the following? Think of a rubber band. That's all I'm going to say there. Calculate the effective static compliance given the following information about a patient receiving mechanical ventilation. I give you the peak inspiratory pressure, the plateau pressure, their exhaled tidal volume, and their PEEP. Static compliance is static. You're measuring it at plateau pressure. That's all I'm going to say there. A patient receiving mechanical ventilation has an exhaled tidal volume of 500 mils and a PEEP of 5. you do patient ventilator system checks, you reveal the following data. At 6 o'clock in the morning, his PIP was 27 and his plateau was 15. At 8, his PIP was 29, his plateau was 15. At 10, his PIP was 36 and his plateau was 13. Based on the following data above, the respiratory therapist should recommend which of the following for the patient. So the patient's peak inspiratory pressure is rising, but his plateau pressure is not. So based on that data, what is it you need to do? The values below pertain to a patient who's being mechanically ventilated with an exhaled tidal volume of 700 mils. Same thing, I give you times, I give you peak inspiratory pressures, and I give you plateau pressures, and then you need to analyze that data. Because when you have a high peak inspiratory pressure and your plateau stays the same, it means one thing. And then when you have your peak inspiratory pressure going up and your plateau pressure going up, that means something else. Analysis of this data, Question 45, the respiratory therapist should expect which of the following findings while ventilating a patient with ARDS. With ARDS, the patient's lungs are very, very, very stiff. They are non-compliant. It takes a lot of pressure, a lot of force to get air into them. That's all I'm going to say there. Plateau pressure is measured during which phase of the ventilator cycle or ventilatory cycle, okay? Plateau pressure is measured when, okay? The condition that is associated with increased air resistance is which of the following? People miss that one too. I'm not quite sure why. Think of disease processes that cause an increased air resistance. Question 48, an increase in peak inspiratory pressure without an increase in plateau pressure is associated with which of the following? Hey, that kind of correlates back with question 43. So if you get 43 right or 48 right, you should be able to figure those out. 49, calculate airway resistance for a ventilator patient in centimeters per water per liter per second. When the peak inspiratory pressure is 50, your plateau is 15, and your set flow rate is 60 liters per minute. The key to that one is people forget to break it down to centimeters per water per liter per second. You've got to make sure you put it in liters per second. That's where people screw up, and they don't calculate it all far enough out. Okay, your next question is another calculate airway resistance. Just different values. I give you peak inspiratory pressure, plateau pressure, and a set flow rate setting, and you need to calculate the airway resistance. You have three extra credit questions. One is on inspiratory time. One is you're evaluating compliance and resistance to look at what will cause the lung to fill fastest. And then you look at, the last question has to do with air trapped in the lungs due to mechanical ventilation. So that is your midterm exam for RT-110. I will tell you this test really shocks the heck out of quite a few students. You need to prepare appropriately. For some reason, students can do very poorly on this exam, and I don't know if it's because it's the first time I throw so many patient scenarios at you, but you really need to make sure that you're taking the time and that you're really studying appropriately and that you're preparing. And so again, this would have, you're being tested, excuse me, should I need hiccups? You're being tested on chapter 19, chapter 1, and 2, and 3, and 4, I think. Does that sound about right? No, one of those is, I don't know if we've gone to 3 yet. Well, by the time we hit week 4, we'll have gone to chapter 4. So anyways, you really need to understand how BiPAP works. You need to understand the different airway pressures, which let me find the diagram so I can just refer to you to that page because that is a really important one for you to understand. That would be page 4 in your book, PILBEAM. So this whole chapter 1, where it's talking about transthoracic and transpulmonary pressures and compliance and resistance, the airway resistance calculation is on page 7, okay? There is no reason for you to get that question wrong unless you can't do math. And I'm a math idiot, and I can do it. So there's no reason for you not to be able to do that. Table 1-2 on page 6 talks about changes in transpulmonary pressure and the different things that it causes, and it shows it for passive spontaneous ventilation, it shows it for negative pressure ventilation and positive pressure ventilation. The compliance calculation is right here in this chapter as well. It tells you how to do it. Time constants, which has to do with how fast the lung units fill, is on page 8. Time constants is on page 9. That kind of goes with some of those extra credit questions. Page 12 and 13 kind of talks about peak inspiratory pressure and plateau pressure. That's going to become important when you're looking at some of those questions where I give you plateaus and peaks and I ask you what's going on and what do you need to do next. I don't have a lot on, I have next to nothing, I think, on this, on chapter 2, which goes more into the inner mechanics of the ventilator. Didn't get too heavy into that on this exam. I concentrated more on patient assessment kind of stuff, which is 19, I believe, in this book, when we're talking about BiPAP. And again, in this chapter, I don't know if there were a couple case scenarios in here or not. You need to do the questions at the back of chapter 19 in PillBeam. If you haven't already done them, that should help you. We talk about worsening in pH. There's a case study 19-2 on 393. There's a case study 19-1 also on the same page. That will kind of give you you need to do those to get in practice before you start doing these case scenarios on the exam. That should be beneficial for you. Page 384 talks about use of it in a chronic care setting versus an acute care setting. We also talk about indications and symptoms and selection of non-invasive ventilation in the acute respiratory failure patient, which is page 383. We talk about chronic stable chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. We talk about nocturnal hypoventilation patients, restrictive disorders, which those are going to be your neuromuscular type diseases. So if you really concentrate on chapter 19 and chapter 1, let me look at chapter 3 here. I don't even think I got too much into chapter 3. I mean, the bulk of this test is BiPAP in chapter 1 of your book, really, when we start looking at it. So if you've got a good understanding of those two chapters, I think you will be okay. That doesn't mean you don't need to know the other stuff, but I'm testing primarily on those other two. I would highly suggest, if you've not done some of the PillBeam workbook, that you do so. It would also help you prepare for this exam. Routinely, I do, after everyone's taken this exam and I correct the exams, I go over it on an Illuminate and record it so that you can understand why you missed certain questions. So you can probably figure Monday the 21st, because your exam's on the 17th, that I will be going over it and discussing it in detail. I think that you should all do fine if you prepare appropriately. I don't remember which page in your book the oxygen hemoglobin dissociation curve is. If you can't find it in PillBeam, I know it's there somewhere. Look it up in Egan, look it up in your little Oaks book, wherever you got to find it. Make sure you understand it and what that relationship, what curve that relationship depicts. All right, I'm gonna stop beating the dead horse. I will see you all at 8 o'clock on July the 17th. Between now and then, I may see some of you at my clinical site visits. Happy studying.